This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Well, on the 9th anniversary program, I was very, very proud to have as my guest Tasha Alexander and her husband, Andrew Grant. Andrew Child, as some of you know him, who has now taken over the Reacher books with his brother, Lee Child. They called in from London, so I spent the entire hour talking to them. Well, you know, that was so fantastic that they would call in just in time for the 9th anniversary and to tell me that they are enjoying the daffodils over in England. I didn't have time to announce the Patsy Award winner for 2023, and I want to do that now. It is Douglas Brunt, because my favorite book of 2023 is his book, The Mysterious Case of Rudolf Diesel, Genius, Power, and Deception on the Eve of World War I. Now, if you haven't read it yet, you really must read it. There are so many things in this book that will just open your eyes and you will just love it. It is so well written. Well, Douglas Brunt, he wrote one of my favorite books, Ghosts of Manhattan. He was the fourth guest on Joy on Paper. And what is really exciting about this is that today I'm gonna play that interview. So that's all the way back to 2015 when I started Joy on Paper. I want to play that because I love that interview. But I also just want to announce, right now he's traveling. And so as soon as he gets back to New York, we're going to do an interview on Joy on Paper Live, which is on YouTube now. So you can listen to us both on the radio, because I'm continuing the radio program because I love the radio program. And it is so much fun to talk to authors and to really get to know them and introduce their books to people. But I'm also doing the live program so that I can do some longer format type of things with video and stuff. So you can find us in both places, here on the radio and on YouTube. But the winner of the Patsy Award is Douglas Brunt, and he will be with me and soon, and I will let everyone know. But meanwhile, I want to just play this wonderful interview. It's surprising, you know, I didn't remember that I was so good. I think I'm pretty good in this interview, because of course I was blushing, because I was actually flirting with the guy. I think that I was crazy, I think, but he was very kind to me. And so I want to run this interview and then to play a little music at the very end. Anyway, thank you again for everyone who sent me nice emails, really great emails, and I appreciate it. So enjoy this interview. Whoa, 9 years ago. So here goes. I have a very special guest today, best-selling author Douglas Brunt. Douglas Brunt. His first book was The Ghosts of Manhattan.
We'll have Manhattan, the Bronx and Staten Island too. It's lovely going through the zoo. It's very fancy on old Delancey Street, you know. The subway charms us so when balmy breezes blow to and fro.
Hi, Doug.
Hi, Patsy. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, thank you. This is a real treat for me, and I just want to say that, you know, on Joy on Paper, one of our goals is to encourage writers to follow their dreams, and I think your story is so inspirational. You gave up your job as a CEO of an internet security firm and turned to writing. It must have been a big decision for you.
It was. It was a big family decision, but has turned out to be a great one. I have always loved writing and was really grinding myself out running the security company, a lot of travel, and I enjoyed it. Entrepreneurship I've enjoyed, but clearly my passions were elsewhere, and took a bit of a leap, but so far it's working out.
It's worked out beautifully.
By the way, that was about the best intro I think I've ever had.
Oh, thank you. Well, we wish that you were here for this Beach Babes book blast, which is very hard to say, but you are so gorgeous. I'm looking at you. I'm looking at you right now on your Facebook page, so it's hard to sort of distracting. I think I have to turn the screen off.
Well, I could use a little Tampa weather now. That would be nice.
Well, we're going to get you down here, that's for sure. Had you finished The Ghost of Manhattan when you quit your day job, or did you just like quit and start writing?
I was through a first draft. I wasn't finished, and I didn't have a book deal yet. But I sold the company and then focused on writing full-time. I had really just been moonlighting and writing mostly on airplanes and airport terminals waiting for planes while I was running the company. And in that way, finished a first draft of the book.
It's amazing. For a first book, well, for any book, I mean, it is so riveting. It's so compelling. And you've combined humor and with it that, it's just an amazing book. I just love it. And, you know, when writers are always told, you know, they have to find their voice. Well, you certainly found it with your main character, Nick Farmer. Tell us a little bit about his world in 2005.
The book is set in Manhattan on Wall Street, and Nick Farmer is a bond salesman for Bear Stearns. It's in the years, obviously, leading up to the 2008 mortgage crisis, and he was trading some of the financial instruments, mortgage-backed securities, that led to the crisis. And the book is largely about a marriage, but one that is struggling due to his work involvement. And on Wall Street, as in sales and trading, so much of it is around entertainment and nightlife. And so, of course, he's out at the bars late night and strip joints, and there's cocaine. So it does explore a lot of real life of what happens in sales and trading on Wall Street and the tensions that creates as someone is getting a little bit older and trying to establish a family. So it's not meant to be some Wall Street expose. It's really just the backdrop for this marriage. And it's kind of a story of redemption and how Nick is going to resolve these two things and, you know, how he's going to ultimately set up his life.
Well, you know, here in Florida, where just about everybody suffered from the crisis that happened in 2008, and we all lost value in our homes. My first thing when I started, I thought, oh, I hate this guy. I hate everybody. You know, I hate all of them. But of course, you have made it so intriguing. The way you've explained how it happened, I think it's perhaps the best explanation I have seen, better than anything on any television show or any other book or any newspaper article. You made it easy to understand, and I really think every first year college student should read it and have this in mind, because it's a really eye-opening book. And I love all of Nick's comments, which are so insightful into what was going on there and about his colleagues. Was that what you were hoping for, to open people's eyes?
Yeah, it's interesting to see what happened. I mean, of course, on the financial talk shows and things and in the newspapers, the crisis has been analyzed in a million different ways, except the only way is not in a way that humanizes all of the people involved and tells it. You know, you can see the crisis come about as it unfolds in this fictional story where the characters are humanized. And, you know, if you look at someone, you know, everyone villain sort of made villains of the Merrill Lynch traders and other traders like that. And when you think about these guys who are in their 20s and coming out of college and they're looking at different jobs, who wouldn't say no to a job on Wall Street that's going to pay you a few million dollars when you're a young person, man or woman, and although it tends to be the men in these roles, to spend, you know, you sort of work market hours, which are pretty easy, and then you're out to expensive dinners on expense accounts all the time, and they're going to pay a few million dollars. I mean, that seems like something a lot of people would sign up for, and it's not their responsibility to have the global economy, you know, in their hands. People like Moody's and Standard & Poor's ought to be rating bonds with a low grade if they're if they're bad bonds. But that didn't happen. You know, there was Moody's really, there are a number of different points along the way where the crisis could have been addressed and sort of headed off. Moody's and Standard & Poor's is one place that I think a large part of the blame goes, because they looked at these products and put an A rating on them, and they were terrible. They were ticking time bombs. And the traders were just shuffling around. And, you know, these traders are compensated based on volume. And the more trades you do, the more you're going to make. So, of course, they acted according to the way their compensation schemes are set. And so the crisis just got bigger and bigger and bigger.
Well, it's frightening. And I know that, as I said, here in Florida, we suffered from it. One of the things.
Florida was.
Oh, it devastated here. We still have nightmares. You know, one of the things in your book, you are so insightful, and your comments on all of the different traders are so clean and crisp. Tell me, did your friends know you were that insightful before they saw that you could write it all down? Are they like afraid of you now? Like, okay, maybe I'm not going to have this second gin and tonic because I'm going to hear about it.
In and of, that is funny. I have had a few people remark to me that, you know, so I came to writing later in life, and people didn't know that I was doing this. And one friend who we've known for years said later, like, now I am wondering constantly when we're at dinner what you're really thinking. You know, you're sort of having a conversation, but somewhere in the back of your mind, you're making these internal observations and
making
notes for books later on. But yeah, and a few people have made some comments like that. The main character, Nick, is a fun sort of. So the book is written in first person, as you know, and he's sort of a fun character to go through the journey with, because he makes interesting observations, largely cynical ones. But he does become a likable character, even though he's doing what everyone, you know, he, as a person in sales and trading, he's leading to what makes everyone so furious.
Well, he is cynical and often actually cruel, but he does have these redeeming features, and that, you know, his relationship with his sister and some of his other relationships are the way he treats the character Freddie, you know, who is trying to warn everyone about the dangers of what they're doing. It really redeems him, and you come to really like him and hope that, you know, everything's going to turn out for him. So, but as a matter of fact, that name, Nick Farmer, you know, I love that name. I thought it was so great. You know, Nick is sort of a sophisticated, it has both, it's sophisticated, but it's sort of like Nick and Nora Charles. And at the same time, it sort of has a little gangsterish, you know, sound to it. But then Farmer is so beautiful and clean and, you know, American and wholesome. And did you think about that juxtaposition of those names?
I did.
Yeah?
Yes. Yeah. For the big characters in my books, I do put a lot of thought into the names. And then there are so many names, though, in the course of the novel. Sometimes I'm just sitting in the library where I write, and I'm introducing a character and need a name, and I'll just sort of walk the stacks a little bit and pick the name of an author, or combine, you know, the first name of one and with the last of another, and just sort of come up with a name that way.
Well, I think that Nick Farmer is going to be one of those names that, you know, it's going to just go down forever in history as a perfect name for a character. So you did a great job on that.
Thanks.
You know, one of the things I love about Ghosts of Manhattan is the pacing. You don't rush to make your points. And, you know, it's so tempting, and I think probably maybe even for a first writer, even more tempting, to toss sort of everything in at once. But you have a great way of just sort of dropping a few words that add suspense, and you don't know, is there going to be a payoff, or is this, you know, what's going to happen? And, like, in Ghost Manhattan, you don't mention one of the main characters until, you know, like halfway through the book. And I don't know, Rebecca, you know, I think I can say that name. And, you know, it's really, you know, it's great control. Did you, like, you Did you write it out as a outline first? Are you one of those people who does all these arcs of, you know, and outlines, and or do you just let it flow? Oh, no. Okay, one moment. We're going to take a little break. Hold up.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, I'm John Rakowski with Charles Ruttenberg Realty. Don't you love living here in the Tampa Bay area? Oh, I'm sorry, you don't live here yet? Well, if you already are or thinking about it, call me at my office at 727-538-9200 extension 2 for any real estate needs, including a free market analysis of your home. Your home is worth more than you can imagine. Call me today at 727-538-9200 extension 2. I'm John Rakowski.
Are you looking for the perfect gift? Going to a wedding? A special birthday? The Silver Queen is the place to go. Graduations are coming up. Don't settle for the ordinary. At the Silver Queen, you will find a unique gift. Things that you won't find at the mall. From beautiful photo frames to silver and china, you will find just what you're looking for. One that says, you care. Guys, looking for that perfect ring? You'll find it at the Silver Queen. And don't forget their bridal registry. Located at 1350 West Bay Drive in Largo, the Silver Queen is the place to go. Visit their website, silverqueen.com. They have some wonderful coupons. And when you go to the store, tell them that Patsy with a Z sent you.
Hi, it's Sawyer from the Dolphin Tale movies. Now is the perfect time to visit the world-famous Clearwater Marine Aquarium. Millions have seen us around the world, and now you can experience what we do in person. Come and reconnect with Winter and her fun-loving movie co-stars, Hope, Mavis, and yes, that crazy bird, Rufus. Immerse yourself into the world of marine life rescue with the behind-the-scenes tour. Explore the film sets, and don't miss our free boating adventure. Save time in line when you buy tickets at seawinter.com. Kids only $16.95.
If you would like to become a wholesale buyer of the premium quality longevity products you hear about right here on the...
A dream that I can call my own. I found a thrill to press my cheek to. A thrill that I have never known.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z. And we're back with my guest, Douglas Brunt. Hi, Doug, are you there?
I'm here, Patsy.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
No, that's all right. We dropped you. Or you dropped us. I don't know what happened. There's always something. That's why, you know, when I first looked at your picture on Facebook, I said to myself, okay, I wish I had a budget and I would send him a ticket. And he could come down here and sit with me in the studio. And because actually, you know, up until now, I didn't mind not having the guest in the studio. But once I saw your Facebook page, I said, oh, I need a TV program. I really need a TV program. I want you here in the studio.
You are very kind.
Well, you know, anyone, you know, I know I did offer to tape you at midnight, which I, because you got confused about the time. Any woman looking at your picture would do the same. Tell me, I don't know, now I'm blushing. I don't know where I dropped off. I was complimenting you on your great use of suspense, but doing it so easily without, you know, without shoving it in people's face. Just a few lines. It's amazing how you do it.
Thank you. I you know, those are the books, the kind of books with that kind of writing are the ones I enjoy reading as well, and that's just the way I've, the writing style I have, which is fairly quick scene setting. Just a couple of interesting things that can give you a flavor for it. You know, there's so much, you could spend paragraphs and paragraphs just talking about a room, but it's interesting just to have the one or two details that kind of bring it home. And
exactly.
I do that both with a physical setting as well as a character. I don't spend a lot of time talking about what somebody looks like. It's just one or two things that are a little more intimate that kind of get you there quickly.
Well, you're doing it so beautifully. And it, as I said, it was so, when I first read it, Ghost of Manhattan, I said to myself, wow, this isn't a first book, because you're doing it really, it looks so effortless. But of course, every writer knows that if it looks effortless, there was a lot of effort behind it. So you've just done a great job. Book titles are so important. And, I don't think The Sun Also Rises would have been such a bestseller if Hemingway had kept his original title. Do you know what it is?
I don't know that story.
What was the original title? Original title. And actually, it's sold in some foreign countries using this title, Fiesta. I would never have read that book if it was, I know that. I would never have picked up a book called Fiesta. Now, but even a better one, and somebody that I know you, a writer that you really admire. Now, his book is a required reading in almost every high school English class. But I don't think they would require it if they had the original title, The High Bouncing Lover. Now,
High Bouncing Lover.
Can you, sort of a rather unpleasant image. Which of your favorite writers had that title as a working title?
Gosh, I have no, John Irving? I don't know.
No, F. Scott Fitzgerald for The Great Gatsby.
Wow.
Of course, he was going to do the East Egg one also, but can you imagine The High Bouncing Lover? It would not be it would not be in any high school English class today.
Right, that would have changed everything.
Oh, absolutely. And the movie, too. I don't think we'd have, well, I don't know, maybe a movie, but not the kind of movie that most of us want to see. how did you come to The Ghosts of Manhattan, which I love the title, and it's evocative, and I love Manhattan. So, and you really make me feel when I was reading the book that I was in Manhattan. But how did you decide on that title?
That title came pretty before the first draft was done. It was sort of a third of the way through the first draft, and it was sort of a constant process of thinking about the title. And I had a plan for the whole book, so even though before I sat down to write the draft, I think it's very hard to start writing and prior to having all the ideas pretty well set, at least for me. And so I knew what the whole book was going to be about, but in terms of the actual writing of the draft, I was about a third of the way in when I thought of that title and liked it, but was open-minded. And then in the end, really, the more I was into the book, the more I thought that was the right title. So, for the second book, the title came much later. I thought of the title for The Means, which is the political fiction book, long after the first draft was done, and I had gone through, nothing as crazy as High Bouncing Lover, but I'd gone through a number of other ideas for that title. And then the book I'm working on now, I had the title even before I started, started writing the first draft. Once I had the ideas set, the title I knew right away. So we'll see if it changes, but I think I'm set on that.
You have, as I said, first, you really make Manhattan come alive. I really felt like I was there. And you also have a lot of what I call delicious moments, moments where you write something, and I know as a writer you think, oh, I really like that, and then you hope the reader will really like that.
Right.
So are you familiar with that, with the Cary Grant movie Arsenic and Old Lace? Have you ever seen that?
No.
Well, you have to get it. It's not just a classic. It's, I think, Cary Grant's best movie, and that's saying a lot. But in there, when you get it, there's a taxi driver, and nobody ever thinks, he's just a taxi driver. And it's really what we call the role itself is small, but the part is big. It sets the tone. Mm-hmm. And once you see that movie, you'll always remember the taxi driver. A forgotten actor, Gary Owen, nobody remembers him now. But without him, the movie would not have been the same. And I think that's your doorman scene in Ghosts of Manhattan reminded me of that, that it's a small part, a small little bit, but it does set the tone.
And that, so it can reveal a lot about a person, and it can set a pace and a tone for the book. So Arsenic and Old Lace, I will look that up.
Oh, you have to. You'll love it. It's just the movie to see. Now, speaking of movies, have you signed a movie deal for The Ghosts of Manhattan yet?
I have not, although I just recently signed with a book-to-film agent.
Okay,
well. So I have a literary-only agent now, and when it goes to book-to-film, they co-agent with other folks. So I've just signed with someone who is shopping it around.
Well, I don't think that they'd have to shop this one around. This is going to be a movie, I can tell you that. They're going to have a hard time if they say, well, we would like the Nick Farmer character to look like the author. They're going to have a hard time finding anyone as good looking as you, but they will. It's going to be a movie, and I love that you have Manhattan in your title, because there are some great songs that will go along with it. So I'm sure that it's going to be. It's going to be done. Okay, you can take it from me. You're going to have a movie. And just do make sure that you keep that, you know, I've adapted books for screenplays before, and oftentimes they want to drop really important little scenes, like the doorman. And so make sure when you sign your contract that you keep in that you can have some of your favorite scenes in there, because otherwise they disappear. So,
well, if I get a contract in front of me, I'll be sure to come back to you for some thoughts on that. I haven't been through that process yet, so I'm sure to make a few errors.
Oh, it's a process. it's a fun and challenging process, and you have to be very strong to make sure that nobody destroys what you've written, because it's really great, and I know it's going to be a great movie. And just like Ghosts of Manhattan is going to be a great movie, I know that when they get to the means, we're going to be also talking a movie deal at some point. You know, why I started Joy on Paper was to encourage writers and to motivate them. So many writers, you know, they start and then they don't know what to do and they give up. It's a challenge. It's hard to find, you know, an agent, and it's hard to find an outlet, but things are changing in the publishing world, and there are a lot of ways to get to move ahead. You know, when you were writing, you said that you've been writing for a long time, but even as a child, did you ever think that someday I'm going to be a writer?
I loved reading and fooling around with writing. I guess I didn't have the courage as a real young guy to think that it was ever a realistic goal. So I didn't set out to be a writer in any way. I just didn't have maybe wasn't thinking big enough to think that that was something practical or realistic to go after. And so I never set out in any kind of professional way to be a writer. I was always on a very different professional path. And even when I started writing the first draft of Ghosts of Manhattan, was doing it only as a hobby, as a way to relax, and because I enjoyed it. Instead of writing to relax or reading to relax, I would write a little bit. And then when I finished it, my wife read it and she said, "This is actually pretty good. You should try to get an agent." You know, I really enjoyed reading the book, and I thought, "Wow, well, that would be amazing." But still, what a crazy idea! But through a friend, found an agent who was willing to take a look and give me some advice on, you know, where to go, and then the agent actually came back and said, "If you're willing to work with me a bit on this, I'd like to represent you." Of course, I said, "Great," and that's how it got started. It was you know, 6 or 8 months of working iterations of drafts with the agent before, you know, finally getting a deal.
Well, the agent.
So, long way of saying, no, I never really, as a youth, I didn't think this is what I'd be doing. But of course, if someone said, "Would you like to do that?" I would have said, "Of course, that would be the dream."
Well, the agent made a great decision, and so that led from your first book to your second book, The Means, which for some reason you've added the word the novel, or a novel. I don't know why, because The Means was was enough, and it's another, you know, you do in The Means to politics what you did to Wall Street and Ghosts. You sort of open up a can of worms and let them all squiggle out there in all their disgusting glory. Did you do a lot of research for the Means?
For the Means, I did much more research than I did even for the first one. The first one, I knew a lot about the financial crisis. I live in Manhattan. I have a number of friends who work on Wall Street in various roles that the characters in the novel played. And so I knew a lot there, but I did a little bit of research for the first, but not nearly as much. And the second, I really had to get inside politics, presidential campaigns, life on the road of a campaign, both from the perspective of the operatives running the campaign and from the media and from the candidate. And so most of the research I did was primary research, getting together with these folks who have run presidential campaigns, people who've worked in the White House. I had dinners with a number of congressmen and congresswomen, people who have been press secretary in the White House, things like that. And so I was able to get a lot of information, but just importantly, I was able to hear how they talk and how they talk with each other, and that helped me get the voice right for some of the characters.
Yes, and you wrote this in a completely different voice. First, you used third person, and it seems like, you know, here you're stepping back and you're more of a distant observer to the manipulation of voters by both parties. Was it a harder book to write?
It was challenging in that regard. So, as you say, I wrote it in the third person, and there are three main characters, and so three separate plot lines that then, as you know, come together in the end in a way that you wouldn't expect. And so that was a little bit more complicated of a structure for the book than the first, which is really this linear journey that you're sort of at the hip with Nick Farmer and just travel through in the first person in this sort of sequential linear way. The other one was much less, was not linear. But you're right in that it was similar in that I went behind the scenes, you know, in the first one, Wall Street, and the second one, politics, but going behind the scenes and getting into sort of the real day-to-day and giving people kind of a look around. And in both cases as well, the reader is posed with this decision to make of whether people are essentially good and our frameworks can cause all these problems, like on Wall Street. You know, all these people are sort of acting in reasonable, benign ways, but, you know, the way Wall Street is set up and all these schemes and compensation things screw it all up, or whether people are essentially bad actors and we need the frameworks to sort of curb human nature, which is essentially bad. And it's the same in politics. You know, these people who get into politics, are they basically good people who then are corrupted by this system that is just hopeless? Or is it only the bad people who would ever go into politics in the first place? And so those are kind of some of the themes that are explored in really both books.
I believe there's always, like, mysterious links between people that you don't recognize and you don't know, and sometimes it's a fleeting moment. And it's funny that when I was reading The Means, one of the main scenes is written in takes place in the Delano Hotel in Miami, which I think is my favorite hotel there. And again, with very crisp and clean descriptions, you really make even Miami come alive. You make us feel like we're really there, experiencing the events that took place, that, you know, the characters' actions there. I love the way you described it.
Oh, thank you. That makes me very happy to hear that. Of course, that's what I'm hoping to achieve, so that's nice to hear.
So, yeah, well, you know, all of your characters in that book, it's the more, I think, in because there's more complexity to the individual, like the two characters who are running, in the campaign. Did you base any... Well, no, I shouldn't ask. Maybe you based it on anybody, because then people won't talk to you. It's sort of like... If people are saying, oh boy, he's observing everything I do, everything I say, I'm never going to have another bourbon in front of him because he's going to write about right about it.
Well, the Republican candidate for president, who Tom Pawley in the novel, is a fictional character, not based on anyone. But one thing I would say about it is I was flying out to a debate in Iowa in the lead up to the 2012 election, and sitting right next to me on the plane was Governor Tim Pawlenty. And it was just one class of service, you know, so we're all kind of together. And at that time, he had already withdrawn from the race. He was a candidate, and then he withdrew and put his support behind Romney. And anyway, so so he was going out to support Romney at the debate. And so we got to talking the entire flight. He was a super nice guy. And when I write these characters and I'm doing dialogue, one of my things that helps me do it is to picture someone physically. And so when I was writing Tom Pawley, I would picture Tim Pawlenty in my mind. But really, that, and other than being a fairly affable, nice guy, Tom Pawley, he was not based on Tim Pawlenty in any other way. But I did, as a nod to Tim Pawlenty, just make the initials the same. So Tom Pawley, Tim Pawlenty. But he's not, not based on Tim Pawlenty.
Yeah, we don't want to give away anything, but we don't want to also, I can see that we don't want to get too precise about it. Tell me, this the whole campaign in the means it's like a 4-year period. It's wonderful that you didn't overwrite it. I think most writers would say, well, I've got to fill in all those 4 years. But I like the way that you sort of acknowledge that the reader is smart enough to know, you know, the sort of the pacing of a 4-year campaign, and so you don't have to overwrite it.
Thanks. Yeah, I did make some conscious decisions around that to keep the pace of the book going. And exactly, there are these 700-page novels out there that don't need to be that long, because there are so much of it is just not required to keep the story advancing. And so I could have filled up a lot more and sort of accounted for each, you know, week and day of the campaign, but it just didn't matter.
Exactly.
To advance the story.
Sometimes there's just too much.
Pacing is important for the book, and just as aesthetically, and even in some of the scenes, it's important to kind of keep people moving around and keep the story active. So I do think about that when I'm writing.
Well, another coincidence or sort of mystical connection to you is that after I read Ghosts of Manhattan, but before I read The Means, I read For Whom the Bells Toll. Now, it was funny that in The Means you mention it, and I assume that Hemingway, like for most of us, is one of your favorite writers.
Yes.
But I don't want, you know, I might make you blush, but, you know, I think in many ways, if Hemingway were alive today, he would be writing like Douglas Brunt. Because, if you look back, if you pick up For Whom the Bells Toll, you know, it's a fantastic book, and we all love it. But now when you go back and you read sentences like, in the fourth paragraph, he says, I do not remember. And then you cannot. And all of this, you know, all of the sort of no contractions. And what you'd say don't and can't, and you even say I'd, which isn't very common. But it's so much crisper, and it's clearer, and it's, Hemingway admired muscular writing, strong writing, and I think that's what we get in you. You know, a nice, crisp, clean writing, and it's enjoyable. As I said, I like long books if the long books are full of interesting things that I want to read, you know, about. But I do admire that you've, keep it directed. Always, you see after, you know, when like you get to the end of your books, both of them, and particularly The Means, you understand sort of all of the things that you've written along the way that really tell the story. It's really great.
Oh, thanks. I try to keep the prose spare, and keep things moving a bit.
Well, you do. And did we hear a baby back there a little while ago? Did I hear?
There was a baby passing through the other room.
Okay. Well, that's nice.
On the way to a nap. I do a fair amount of my work from home, but I also work at the public library on 42nd. And Fifth Avenue in New York, Midtown, that big, beautiful public library.
Oh, I love it.
Is usually where I will get my writing done.
Well, I can write anywhere like you too. It depends on what I'm writing. I like to have noise around me. Although I do, there's a book I'm working on, and I'm up at 0400 hours. On the mornings that I'm working on that book, because it is a book about pilots, F-105 pilots, and they got up at 0400 hours, and I figured if they could get up at 0400 hours to take off, then I want to be up at that time, and I...
You're like a method actor.
Well, it is. It is. I have to be, because it's a very... The F-105 pilots were... in the most incredible group of pilots. They faced death every day, and many, many never returned. And so it's a very tragic and compelling story, and I want to do the best I can for them. And so I find that working at 0400 is the best time for me. But so
you're, with some coffee, I assume.
Oh, absolutely. Just you know, I'm ready. I mean, I'm ready to climb into the cockpit, and it's so much fun for me to. And I play the music, the sounds. I have the sounds of the runway, so I know what it sounded like, and I play that also.
Oh, that's great.
And I play a song, and as a matter of fact, I'm going to play that after I finish talking to you today, because I have many of my the pilots who are now 50 years on from the time that they were in Operation Rolling Thunder, and many of them are listening today, and I know they were all excited to hear that you were my guest, and so I know that they're listening, and I'm going to play their song for them. So I hope you'll, once you're off the phone, you'll listen. I think you'll find it an amazing song. You know, I always ask, you know, what advice do you have for writers? What up and coming writers? What do you want to advise them to do besides a page a day or something like that?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, the sort of common advice on this is keep reading and writing. You know, and of course that's true. The writing, you know, some people say write every day, and that is good if you can. It doesn't have to be on the novel. It can be a journal or emails or something, but just the practice of putting sentences and thoughts together is great. But more than that, I think, is the ideas. You know, writing really is your perspective on the world, your ideas, and how you can put that together into an interesting story. If you're writing fiction, how you can put that together into an interesting story. And my advice would be, you know, some writers, like we've talked about Hemingway and Fitzgerald and others, some writers, I think Hemingway used to just kind of get to a blank page and let the story go where it may. I do a lot of preparation before that. I don't have that talent to just sit down and riff out a novel. And so before I start even page one, I've got 100 or more pages written about the book. And so that is the easiest way to get started, I think, too, because there's a lot of pressure to get the first sentence right and then keep it going from there. But there's no pressure to just kind of write about it. So I'll write about the characters. I'll write about the plot and some themes I want to hit. And I may sketch out pieces of dialogue if there's a scene that I have exactly in my mind, but even if it's three quarters through the novel, you know, in my thoughts of where it might be, you know, I might write out certain scenes and bits that I can come back and sort of plug in. But it's important to just sort of get things moving a little bit. And then once you have those 100 or so pages, you can start putting some structure to it. And in my case, I will then do a chapter outline. And I don't stick to that in a very rigid way, but that's roughly, when I finish my chapter outline of the book, it's going to look pretty close to that. I may add a few, delete a few, and move a few around. But once I have that framework, then I'll start writing the first sentence, the first page, and I'll have all the supporting stuff. So then when I start the book, I've got a chapter one outline that could be 4 or 5 pages of thoughts in a kind of structured format, and that makes it much easier to get going, and it kind of keeps you on track through the book. Because I've, you know, once I'm done that, I've got a chapter two outline all through, you know, 40 chapters of the book. And so the preparation phase can take months. But in sitting down to a novel, I think it's really important, the way my mind works, to be prepared.
Well, Doug, thank you for the advice, and thank you for joining me today. I don't know if your next book is going to be a romance novel, but if it is, I hope that you will be your own cover model. And again, thank you so much for joining us. It was really wonderful, and I'm thrilled. I know I wanted to just add that I had read that one of your favorite writers is Nelson DeMille. And
I love Nelson. He's become a friend and mentor as well.
Well, I also read his books like almost religiously. Because I like to keep his voice in my head, and I make it a point of rereading his books every few months just to keep him in my head, because his writing is so terrific. And so it was great to talk to you and to know. I'm glad to know that you're great friends, and maybe you can give him a hint and he can come to my show. I'd love to interview him too. And meanwhile, just thank you so much.
He's got one coming out in May, I think.
I have to talk to him, because I love him so much. So thank you again, and it was wonderful. And go kiss the baby and have a great day. And I hope you do listen. I will play the song for the F-105 pilots after a few messages. Thank you.
I'll listen in. It was great to be with you, Patsy. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Doug. I appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I want to dedicate this song to Doug, who is listening, and I thank him for his interview today. His smile reminds me of one of my F-105 pilots. So please listen to this song about the F-105 pilots.
I love my plane. It is my body. I am its brain. My Thunder Chief loves me, and I love her too. But I get the creeps with only one seat and one engine too. She's faster than lightning, it says on her dials. To get a thud airborne takes only 2 miles. She's packed with transistors, black boxes, diodes. But stay alert, cause you might get hurt when she explodes. She totes more bombs than a B-17. My F-105 has a gun and she's mean. But there is one thing that curdles my blood. It's lonesome up there alone.
Hi, it's Patsy again.
WTAN Clearwater.
FM 106.1.
WDCF Dade City.
FM 102.3.
Listen.
It's time for the Thursday edition of Canada Calling, the news from home for vacationing Canadians. Prior to speaking from Toronto, thanks for joining.